Gettysburg Seminary presents the Seminary Explores podcast. Conversations on faith, art, people, politics, theology, life, and more. With voices from around the corner and around the globe. Welcome to the Seminary Explores. I'm Katie Giebenhain with Seminary Ridge Review. My guest is Gary Fink, multi-genre author and professor of English at Susquehanna University. Gary, welcome to the Seminary Explores.
I'm glad to be here.
You've published 30 books. You are a poet, a journalist, a fiction writer, and a creative nonfiction writer. You've won many prizes, but you are also what I consider to be a workhorse of a writer. Some people have misconceptions about creative writing, so this is why I'm emphasizing this. Is this also how you see yourself?
Well, you know, people think I'm prolific, I guess, because of the number of books. But I would say, you know, for the most part, they're probably right. In other words, as my students know, I don't know how many emulate me, but yeah, I'm an early riser, and something's gone wrong, or something else is going on if I'm not upstairs at 6 a.m. Making myself available as a writer. Although some mornings I go to the gym that early. I'm also that guy who the gym opens at 5:45, but that means I can, you know, get back. Usually I go on the days I have classes, you know, so that it doesn't interfere. But most of the time, yeah, there's a time in the day set aside for at least trying to do the writing, the original drafts or the rewrites, or some days just reading.
Mm-hmm. Thinking about seminary students, what would you, as a writer and a teacher of writing, teacher of all kinds of writing, like to say about these are also fellow workhorses, so to speak, who have to write a lot and write on deadline and are trying to do the best they can and be creative in circumstances that are not always easy? Do you have some...
Wow, how to find that's time to really do the best job you can. I was lucky back in those days when I was in a PhD program and I was teaching full time, but I was married. Since you met my wife, she was phenomenal about that. And then when we started having kids. And so I imagine there are seminarians with children and so on.
Yeah.
And that changes your life. And frankly, at that point, I didn't do much creative writing. I had to do the writing for school, and I had to read the work of all the students I had at a Penn State campus where the classes were three times as large as the ones I teach now. I was young, you know. If you're 24 or something, I was a 23-year-old college teacher. Some of the students were as old as I was. But, hey, discipline, I guess. Yeah. I mean, I don't think there's any other way. For me, self-discipline and persistence, and this just happens to be, you know, where I can do that. I started college as pre-med. I didn't have the self-discipline for pre-med. I could tell. I was pre-med because there was an expectation if I was going to go to college, be a doctor. And no one in my family had ever gone to school or anything. My sister and I were first-generation college students. And I remember the choices were something like doctor, lawyer, or minister, interestingly mm-hmm. enough. I'm sure if my grandmother would have had her way, that's what she always said when I was growing, oh, you'll make a wonderful minister, you know, in the Lutheran church, and for my father in particular, the church was enormously important. But I didn't really know what lawyers did, but I knew what doctors did. And so I said, okay. But I knew by the end of my freshman year, I could see the other people had a whole different attitude toward this. And the only class where I had an attitude that was similar to the people who were working hard were literature classes, you know. And at some point I understood that it was okay to study literature, but I wanted to at least take my chance at trying to create some. So even as I was getting a standard PhD in modern American literature, that's about the same time that I was beginning to try my hand at seeing if I could do this. And so once I left that behind and left that Penn State campus behind, all my attention has been to my own creative work.
You've brought something to read?
Sure. I marked off a few things. And this poem isn't that long. I tried to pick something that doesn't go more than a page, and I think I can do it. I think it's relatively self-explanatory, so I don't have to go on and on. But in this case, the poem begins in an image that's just given to me because of something that I read. I'm fond of reading. In fact, I'm more fond of reading science books as you know, as an adult than I was as a student. But I read all sorts of things like that. And in many ways, there's just the discovery, because sometimes you just stop and go, oh. And then what can I do with that? And I think maybe a listener would be able to tell what happens here. This poem is called Selflessness. In the animal kingdom among fish, one father carries all of the laid eggs in his mouth, 65 days starvation to make that flexible, deep mouth a womb. Such sacrifice, spitting them out at last, following that fast with the daily chores of parenting, to guard them while they feed or take them back into his mouth like God. Those babies need to grow before something hungry finds them. They need a place to sleep safe enough to wake again to feeding, watched carefully by their selfless father. He's a living prayer, that catfish who knows each child as he opens his mouth for them. Though every father has limits, and so does this one, turning his back one morning as they feed, swimming away while he still knows them, before his children grow so large he can't tell them from what he hungers for. If he forgets to flee, he will eat them.
Mm, nice. And which book is this from?
This is from a book called The History of Permanence, which once upon a time won the prize from Stephen F. Austin University Press, 2011.
Okay. And is this the same press that you have another book coming out this
year? Yeah, there's the press. I guess they meant it, because at the end of this month, they're going to release new and selected poems called Bringing Back the Bones, big book for poetry, 270 pages,
wow.
I think.
Excellent.
Which... it surprised me they let me go on that long, but sure. I mean, I've seen all the proofs and so on and so forth. So yeah, it'll be exciting to see something like that, because it covers 12 full length books from over the years. So it's you know, when I think about it, you know, I never thought about it along the way, but you say, wow, you know, I 12 full-length books, and so even then you have to really cut back on all those things. So if there's, I don't know, 80, 90, 100 pages per book, that's 1,000 pages. Yeah, so you know, and then they had me do some new ones, I think, simply for marketing purposes. But it was fun doing that, and a lot of the poems, you know, I'm reading them, you know, 15, 20 years later, and they and now they read differently, you know, as if someone else read them.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the books I brought along are ones that I'm still in touch with, but some of those are from when I could still play tennis and run.
That's right. You were at Susquehanna University. You coached tennis for over 2 decades, didn't you?
21 years.
Wow.
Uh-huh. And that's been 15 years now. Wow. I just put the rackets away. You know, this knees don't work forever. You're always putting your weight on them in the exact same way over and over and over.
Yeah. Well, did you, I think you have another example of something.
Sure, yep. I marked off two. This one's going to, you know, I tried to have the other one be a little bit different, plus it's from a different book. This one's called Reviving the Dead. And in many ways, this book is, probably spends a good deal of its time dealing with my father's decline, I think, might be a way of putting, not every poem, but this one, a lot of them feature some, characteristic of him, and it's called The Long Line for Brains, and I think this one's narrative for the most part, so I think people will be able to get it, and the situation itself will be described in the first stanza. When I was doing a visiting writer thing in southern Indiana, actually. In the town I'm visiting at its fair, the longest line leads to brain sandwiches. Pigs this year, my guide says, because mad cow scares off the customers. She's 21, showing me an hour of Indiana before I'm supposed to read my poems about Pittsburgh, where I've eaten liver and hearts, stomach, tongue. Where my father once offered me a choice between a calf's brains and kidneys that he bought fresh for frying. A week of cholesterol on one bun, she says, as if that were the source of fear. Yet there's a whole wheat option, a short list of condiments, including the onions my father mixed with the brains I refused, settling for the kidneys so rich in fat I loved them. See there, he said, now you know. And I sought them out for myself, fed them to my children who loved them too. But here, loitering among 100 Hoosiers swallowing something like a heart attack, I think of my father's heart at 90, despite those Saturday breakfasts of brains, the grease pooling around the scrambled eggs and the rich rye bread he'd baked hours before, on his feet all night, anticipating those meals of organs teaching the body.
Wow. Wow, that's fantastic. And your father actually was a professional baker, wasn't he?
He had his own bakery from, well, from as long as I could remember, in a way. And he closed it 1965, after I began college, primarily because it became more and more difficult in a small town bakeries, and people didn't go to bakeries, you know, neighborhood bakeries so much. And everybody in the family worked. Mm-hmm. My sister went away to school. I went away to school, and my mother's health, she wasn't doing well even at that point. So she couldn't stand on her feet to do that. And if he had to hire somebody, it was not. And then he began to think for the future. Mm-hmm. And I have some poems about that in later books. He became a janitor in the high school where I went to high school. And so he saw that as easy work. He really did. And he chose night work because he was so used to it. And he wanted to be his own boss. Mm-hmm. Almost everybody else that was a janitor wanted to work in the daytime, but if you worked in the daytime, there was a foreman, so to speak, a head janitor, and I could tell all along my father didn't want somebody coming and telling him how to do his work, and so he did the night work. That's the kind of thing that stayed. You know, when I think about it, I'm willing to do early morning work, you know, and take some sort of pride in that. And I'm not very good at taking orders, and I've understood that. Thank God for college teaching where your bosses are more or less your colleagues, you know, so the dean is a friend, so I can go talk to the dean like I'm talking to you right now, and then she makes suggestions, or, you know, as opposed to do this. So I'm just fine. I've been lucky, really. You know, Susquehanna is a great place to do that, and they just gave me a free hand to develop a creative writing program, and I get up every day to do that, going to class. same thing. You know, it's the best part of the day is when you walk in and so on. And plus, I'm blessed. All my students are creative writing majors. Mm-hmm. So they're all self-selected. Mm-hmm. It's about the world's ideal job in in many, many ways, as long as you don't want to be, you know, millionaire or some kind of thing. But that's never interested me anyway.
One of the interesting things about the poem that you just read, I think about sermon writing, okay, and some of the ways in which putting a poem together and putting a sermon together have an affinity.
I would imagine it quite similar. It used narrative, I would think. When did I most pay attention to sermons? When I sat in church. When the minister told a story, mm-hmm. there's no question in my mind. Mm-hmm. When he went off with, generalizations about, and so on, and I just said, well, okay, but the stories, he always brought me back. And I would think that would be ideal. Mm-hmm. There has to be illustration. There has to be a way for people to connect, because that story they can see the connection to their own lives. Mm-hmm. Without that, then that poem is an anecdote. Once upon a time, I went to Indiana to do a visiting writer thing, and the young woman who picked me up at the airport said, hey, you want to go to the fair? And she goes, the most popular thing, it's a brain sandwich. And I went, oh, yeah, okay. But the rest of the poem I didn't think about. That's the anecdote. 6 months later, for whatever reason, probably because I visited my father, and that's about the time he went into the nursing home, and I carried that around, and suddenly I go, oh, yeah, I never ate those brains. I have since, though, uh-huh. with my older son a couple years ago, and I was disappointed. They weren't special in that sense. They had a funny consistency. But I thought there's something about it. The difference between anecdote and poem, and probably the difference between an anecdote and a sermon, because then it leads to that thing that you mm-hmm. want everybody to sit up and take notice and carry out after the service is over.
I was curious if you had some reading recommendations as a writer and as a teacher of creative writing for parish pastors, specifically for what we're just talking about, how you put things together, narrative, how you make these links, and how you do it in some ways that are not so expected, so that people do listen and make... I think when people are listening and they make these connections to their own lives, that's sort of the most satisfying thing you can possibly write.
Yeah, take a creative writing course, personal essay class. Where I teach, the students are required to take a course in nonfiction and one in fiction and one in poetry, but most of them enter as fiction writers. And then some of them get taken with nonfiction when they understand it's about memoir and personal mm-hmm. essay and something called literary journalism. And so sometimes I get the reluctant students, that night class I was describing, the three-hour class. It's a room full of sophomores who are required to take poetry, and not one of them enters the class with eagerness. And so I'm always trying to make that kind of connection. But... one thing I do explain is I write a fair amount of poem sequences. You'll hear me read one. I'll read the title poem later on this evening. And in fact, I visited a colleague's poetry class, and they read that sequence. And then I came in and I talked about how I built it into an essay. Substitute the word sermon for the mm-hmm. word essay here, mm-hmm. The personal essay. And it began, maybe I can even do it. I wonder if I can find this really quickly. So, because I'll remember, right now it begins in narrative. My father sings hymns aloud, wakes each morning expecting to be reborn, telling me three times as if I'm the genie for death, and so on and so forth. So it's a, and it goes on for about a page of some time, because I bought him a book of hymns for a birthday present once, and then I understood after I gave it to him, since he had long since lost his glasses, you know, for you know, and he was farsighted, or and he read the newspaper off the floor. But when he got it, it was obvious he couldn't read the hymns, but he knew them all. And the one thing he could read were the titles.
Sure.
Okay, and plus it was in some kind of calligraphy. It was, you know, they wanted to make it look like it was, you know, the King James hymn book or something. But he, and then he sang. And then he sang, and he could keep it going. So, but there's also an image in part three of this, and here's there's an epigraph, and it says, astronomers now believe Earth once had three moons. In the poem, that comes in part three, and then it repeats itself, and there's a story that a young woman I had in class who said that she began as a twin, and then she apparently had absorbed her twin, you know, as a fetus, and I thought, wow, she told me that. And so that's what kind of triggered this. But when I wrote the essay, I started with the three moon idea because the essay was going to be principally about my father. And so it was all about things that were no longer here. The vanishing of those moons, the vanishing of whatever, in many ways the vanishing of my father, because he was being diminished to the point of not being self-sufficient, et cetera, et cetera. And so it became different. There's only like six lines left from this, but it's, so it's point of entry is one thing I would recommend. You know, where do you? It's really important where you begin. I wouldn't have written this poem in this manner if I had begun with the three moon image. I began with the narrative about my father, and then I had the narrative about the young woman telling me the story. You know, I had her in the intro to creative nonfiction, whenever that was, 5 years ago. And I couldn't get enough of that story. And I said, tell me about it. And then she did. And then I went on and did homework and looked it up and go, wow, this, why didn't I ever hear this? But once I had, okay. And so I was ready to go. And then I happened on that image. And I saw, I'm writing a poem sequence. Everything's available, and so that found its way in. But afterwards, what I went back to was the three moon idea, and then I was writing. Actually, the book was titled "Vanishings" ultimately, because it seemed like all the essays were sort of connected to that. So that would be my theme in a way, or the however you want to describe that in a sermon, but. Boy, as far as constructing something, I would always begin in image. I'd begin in narrative. I'd begin in story. I'd begin in maybe even lines from a poem if you get the right image. Mm-hmm. Or maybe it's just something that Harper's Magazine is wonderful for that. They do. And so I always read, there's a part in the back that has all these sort of oddities out of science. And I don't know enough to write anything scientific about it, but boy, a ready-made image. And sometimes you read it and you go, oh, and then you just wait for the time when something from your own life suggests itself, and then it's a way to begin. The minister is going to come back to familiar threads time after time after time. So I think the way to freshen that is to find new ways from which to begin, and the points of references, and so on. So really, taking a shot at personal essays and how they're constructed and so on, that they're very, very similar for me, the poem sequences, because they're associative.
Yes, yes.
And I don't know how many ministers preach sermons that are constructed associatively, but that's... I teach associatively. I mean, I always know what I'm going to say first in class, and the class is going to go for an hour and a half, and I have like one example, And I start, and somebody says something, or something comes up in what the students have written, and that reminds me of, and then we're off, I hope. And sometimes there's a lot of digressions. And I don't know if ministers can afford to digress too far. But, you know, I can usually sense just by looking around. I mean, I know when it's a fascinating digression. I also mm-hmm. know when it's a digression, they're going, oh.
You can tell. Yeah.
With a little luck, most of the time we circle around and we come back, and there we are. But I guess the major difference is class is more like call and response. You know, the students, I'm asking the students mm-hmm. to break in. Classes work best when they're pretty spontaneous. I don't know if ministers could do that. Maybe some Pentecostal church or something, which I remember going to one once, and I was just like, wow. And that was exciting in a way. Now, the minister, I'm still assuming, is still an authority figure of sorts. And there's distance. Mm-hmm. There's distance. But that's the part, you know, the more you can narrow that distance, and I think story does that. It really does. If it's all pontificating, I'm not sure that's the word I want to use, but it's the word that comes to mind. If it's like that, then the distance widens. And then I don't think people carry anything out the door with them.
And I love how you emphasize the point of entry, because I think for sermons and for poems, that is so important, especially when you're talking about familiar things, right? It's like if you come at something familiar from an unfamiliar direction, that's what, you know, if you don't get people to listen at the beginning, you've lost them, so it doesn't matter if you're saying something interesting later, right? This point of entry is really so important.
Oh, for sure. Everything we read in all the genres, since I teach them all, I call it something a little bit different from genre to genre, but point of entry is really what I mean.
Yeah.
What's this first scene accomplish, or what's this bit of dialogue accomplish, mm-hmm. or how's it located? How do we know where we are and who we're with? And in essays in poems, so I recommend like image. And the students who struggle most with poetry, when they're the prose writers or the students that start with, is beautiful outside. Oh no. And it's hopeless. It really is. And so you write a poem about your grandfather or whatever. I mean, the students are about that age, so their grandparents are fairly old. But if they begin with some quality about, you know, what a kind woman my grandmother is, it's not going anywhere. Let grandma do something. let grandma speak. And then I think they'll be okay. And it also allows them to discover the other way they've already imposed the meaning on the poem before they begin. And then we know mm-hmm. as well. As soon as we read three lines, we know how this is going to work out. Mm-hmm. And then I'm pretty sure, at least for me it is, boring. Then it really is homework. Mm-hmm. I have to write a poem about my grandmother, and I have to let her do at least one thing that I disapprove of, and then show how wonderful she was. No, I never want to write another poem the rest of my life. No, but boy, yeah, you just allow her to be on the page and then find out as you write. It really is the advice, I think, that would stick to a sermon. Mm-hmm. I understand that there's something, a lesson to be taught, I suppose. But if you're already absolutely certain of what that lesson is, I think, you know, the congregation's going to say, yeah, I get it.
Mm-hmm.
And then they're going to think about something else. Yeah. Going to a football game, you know, looking at, oh, you know, it's an hour's drive to the stadium. You know, that kind of thing will creep in. The other way, there's mystery.
Yeah.
And people are always can be curious, you know, so take advantage.
Well, and in putting it together, if you can't surprise yourself, you're not going to surprise the listeners, right?
Yeah, that's so. That's Robert Frost, isn't it? No surprise for the writer, no surprise for the reader, yeah. I think, are words pretty close to that, something like that. And and that's true. And that makes it hard to get up. I don't want to get up at 6 a.m. or 5 a.m. to do that.
Right.
No, not in the least. Yeah. I don't get up to write memos to the dean.
Right.
I do that at 11 o'clock, or in the afternoon, for sure. Yeah.
Well, did you have anything else that you wanted to read today? Or?
Well, if you'd like me to, I can always
I would love it if you would send us off with one more. That would be wonderful.
I was trying to read something that I'm not going to read this evening. Maybe I'll do this. I've never read this poem, again, I was a visiting writer, and this is in Beloit, Wisconsin.
Okay, and
my wife went along on that one too. This one because we flew again, and the host I had a couple hours. And he said, the most interesting thing there is in walking distance is there's an angel museum.
Oh.
Okay, he had me. Angel museum, I'm ready. So here we are. So I'm just taking advantage of this. This is called At the Angel Museum. Memorials, stone figures disconnected from the names they've descended to care for, the wooden, the gilt cardboard, the intricate from paper shaped for full shelves of wishes. Just before closing, a bus idles in the parking lot. My wife and I surrounded by the elderly, many, I'm sure, younger than we are. They carry tiny angels they've created from ribbon and tissues and directions recited by the angel who still flutters among them, glittery in her gold robe, keeping her white wings folded like some luminescent moth at rest. Those fragile keepsakes taken to Minnesota, where that bus is housed, even by the woman who uses a walker, her pale beauty tied to the embroidery of her deep-veined wrist. 8 canes rest in an umbrella stand just inside the door, and when I see there a courtesy, there is so much imminence, so close that the near future almost collapses my knees. And though each cane has a winged woman clinging to its side, there is such shuffling to where a pair of haloed women hover at the tour bus stairs that I am shamed by my smile and flagrantly empty hands. That comes to me. I should read that one tonight. Might be fun. I'd never read that aloud. But that one's just, there it is. You know, we went there, and the anecdote is the tour guide is a woman who is dressed as an angel in all her glory. You know, I was just going over to look for a couple. I couldn't stop following people around. And it really is. It's just all shelves and shelves and shelves of angels. And, of course, there's a gift shop. And then they make them as a kind of craft. And he was right. It was the place to go. And I thought it was a 10-minute walk, walk around the place. And we spent 45 minutes just looking at everything. But it also, as the sermon might, leads to maybe a better understanding of yourself or people who are in a different condition, really, because it was a bus. And those buses always give me the creeps because there's like 40 people and there's 37 women and 3 men because all the men are dead. The women carry on for another 10 years and all those husbands are gone. Very much so. It was a bus like that.
Wow. Well, and this, I wanted to mention, this is actually the newest book that you have out, right?
Uh-huh.
This is called After the Three Moon Era, and it's available from Jacar Press, which is www.jacarpress.com. You've been listening to The Seminary Explores with author and teacher Gary Fink. Gary, thank you so much for your time.
Sure, my pleasure.
You have been listening to The Seminary Explores from historic Seminary Ridge in Gettysburg, Pennsylvania, a production of Gettysburg Seminary. We invite you to visit our website at www.ltsg.edu. Opinions expressed on this program are not necessarily those of Gettysburg Seminary or the Evangelical Lutheran Church in America.